And welcome back. George Norrie with you, along with Kevin Randall. And Kevin, by the way, thank you for serving. My gosh, the Iraq situation, Vietnam, you've really put your dues in, my friend.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
What was the episode when you were a youngster in Colorado that got you interested in UFOs? What happened?
Well, actually, my mother got me interested in UFOs. She took me to the movie when I was a kid, Earth vs. the Flying Saucers. That sparked the interest. But in the 1960s, when I was in high school, the idea was that UFOs were always just blobs of light, fuzzy blobs of light in the distance, never anything really sharp and crisp. And that was kind of the theory the Air Force was pushing around. And a mother of a friend of mine had seen a UFO when they lived on a farm in, I think, South Dakota. And so I said, can I go talk to her about it? And they said, yeah, come on. And the one question I asked her, one thing I wanted to know was it clearly defined? And she said, oh, yeah. It was a disc-shaped object with a dome on top, very clear, sharp edges. It wasn't a blob of light seen in the distance. It was unidentifiable. It was something very distinct hovering over the barn. She got a very good look at it. And that kind of propelled me, I guess, into further investigations of UFOs.
Yeah, interesting. My mother got me involved, too. She brought home a book called We Are Not Alone by Walter Sullivan, who at the time was a New York Times science writer. I couldn't put it down. And then Look magazine comes out with The Interrupted Journey about Barney and Betty Hill and that case. And I was just hooked after that, Kevin. I mean,
I read Sullivan's book as well.
Yep.
I understand that completely. I was hooked by that. And the scientific analysis of things, when you strip away the nonsense, has been pushed in the field from all corners, both skeptical and true believer sides, and you look at the evidence, it leads you to the conclusion that something real is going on, something is happening there. And that was kind of the point with the best of Project Blue Book. Here are the files that the Air Force looked at, and here's, if we look at them carefully, here's what we can actually learn what was going on.
What does your gut and your brain tell you what's going on?
I lean toward the extraterrestrial, alien visitation. I understand the distances. I understand that there really is no good way that we know physically to get from here to another star system. We can't do it, other than like with generation ships or that, which is not to say that somewhere in the future we won't figure out a way to do that. And if we believe that aliens are visiting us, we know that it is possible. And when you know something is possible, you begin to look for it. You begin to understand it. Yep. And say, well, we can't do that. It's impossible. And I think that's one of the important things that ufology brings to us, is this idea. It is possible to travel those interstellar distances. We just have to figure out how to do it.
They learned, I'm convinced, how to bend space and time. And they can travel almost instantly through probably these wormholes or whatever they can create in order to get here.
There are, in science fiction, they explore this all the time. How can we bend space or detect gravity waves or things that suggest there's something going on that we don't understand? And we're beginning to get to that point. And there's always the marvelous discussion, if you put a dot on the top of a piece of paper and at the bottom of the piece of paper, it's like 11 inches apart, folded in half, and then the dots touch. And so if you
exactly
can move space in the same kind of way, then you can move through space very, very quickly.
Yep. Let's go to the calls for you. First-time caller Juan in your neck of the woods in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Hello, Juan. I hope you're okay.
Yes, we're okay. We got light over here at Kirkwood Estates. First-time caller George Norrie. I got my nephews and nieces. They're all into what's going on.
Super.
Yeah, they're excited. They didn't know their uncle listens to this stuff.
Well, give them a quick shout out if they're listening to the show tonight, Juan.
Oh no, they're right here next to me.
Oh, are they? Okay. Hi, kids. How old are they?
I'm 17. My name is Naya.
Hi, Naya.
Well, my name's King.
Well, thank you for both of you for listening and stick with us for a long time. You'll find this to be educational, fun, and everything else. But go ahead, Juan.
My question is like what he was saying, like how all the people, like, you know, they've been, you know, like, I guess, passing away or something. And I guess, you know, myself as an uncle, I'm going to start passing the generation, let them know what's really going on with your show. And it helps a lot, too.
Excellent. It sure does. Absolutely. Kevin, what do you think of that?
Well, first of all, I want to say I'm just utterly irritated that Kirkwood Estates has lights and I don't. We're hoping any moment that will come on, but...
Is it the same power company?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they must be working their tails off, those folks.
It's such a devastation of the entire city was taken down, and they're getting stuff on sporadically. You'll be driving down the street, and the street lights on one will work, and the next one it doesn't.
God.
And it's just that kind of sporadic power grids working for us. I think the thing is we need to invest in the youngsters this curiosity that goes beyond just looking at a computer screen and getting out and talking to people about what they've seen. And you have to filter it all through. You've got the skeptical community that... And some of them do very good work and challenge the ufologists to get the information right, but you've got to look at all of that stuff and filter your way through the nonsense on the ufological believer end, where they're telling us stuff that's just absolutely ridiculous, and the skeptical explanations. Philip Klass, in the Socorro sighting, for example, said, well, it was a plot between the mayor of Socorro and Blani Zamora to create a tourist attraction for Socorro.
Oh, God.
But the thing is, he's partially correct in that there was discussion after the sighting that they might be able to turn it into a tourist attraction. And Glass was saying, well, you know, the mayor owned the land where it landed, and this would be some way to develop it. Turned out he didn't own it, so Glass got that wrong. But it was an idea that, well, there is no alien visitation, ergo there must be another explanation. And so Phil Glass threw that explanation out, and some people have bought it. There is no good explanation for what Lonnie Zamora saw, but we need to invest in the youngsters, this idea that we've got to get out there and look at what's going on in the world around us rather than sitting in front of a computer screen all the time.
Juan, thanks for your call. It was the Socorro, New Mexico, Lonnie Zamora case that convinced Hynek that there was something else going on.
Absolutely, absolutely. And then, of course, the Air Force got annoyed at him because of the swamp gas thing. But I know that Lonnie Zamora, Alan Hynek,
yeah,
and Quintanilla, who was the chief of Project Blue Book at the end there, butted heads quite a bit about it. And the interesting thing Quintanilla was saying about the Zamora sighting, that he labeled it as unidentified, even though there were occupants involved, and he said that he just could not come up with an explanation for it that fit the facts. And I think it's interesting that Quintanilla went that far and labeled it as unidentified, and we can read his take on the case, or what I was able to do is read his take on the case and bring that into the book as well, what he saw or what Quintanilla believed about the Zamora case.
Had you been told or have you heard that higher-ups forced Hynek to say swamp gas in that Michigan sighting?
No, I think that was just a mistake. I think it was the way the thing transpired, and he was sent in to take a look at it. He'd heard some of the descriptions of was Frank Manor, I think it was, and his son had been out there, and there was a swampy area beyond their house where the lights were first seen, the object was first seen. And he got to Michigan, and the press was there, and he was thrown into this press conference, and he said, what do you think it was? And he says, well, it sounds like swamp gas.
Yeah.
And it makes perfect sense, given the circumstances that he was involved in. Had he had a chance to sit down and look at the evidence, he'd have never made that comment.
So exactly.
I don't think he was forced into it. He did have to bend a little bit to his, especially at the end, to the Air Force belief. But when he began, he was a complete and total skeptic. There was nothing to it. But he looked at it with a scientific, rational eye and looked at the evidence and did the research. There's always a story about astronomers never see flying saucers. Well, that's untrue. Hynek did a survey in the early 1950s about it. It was part of the Project Blue Book files. It was classified at the time. And he went talked to, I think it was about 50 astronomers, and some of them had seen things they could not identify. So here are the people you'd look to, and they say, well, astronomers never see them, but they do. Clyde Tombaugh, who discovered the now dwarf planet, Pluto, had a UFO sighting. And Donald Menzel, the great Harvard debunker, said, well, there's a lever of haze in the atmosphere, and it was the windows, lights of the windows around his house that he saw in the sky reflected from this light haze. I'm thinking, Menzel's in Massachusetts talking about the explanation. Tombaugh's the observer. I'm going with what Tombaugh said about the unusualness of what he had seen.
Let's go to Dan in Montrose, New York. Welcome to the program, Daniel. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. So little time. Listen, I know you accept Lonnie Zamora, and I do too, and the 62 school children in Zimbabwe when these ETs came out, and this both happened during the daylight. But what I don't understand is why UFO investigators, and I already know about CGI, not interested in that, mm-hmm. I'm leaning away from that. The UFO landing in China in 2012, September 14th in 2012 on a Friday, is where they saw the craft in the sky first, and it was like going behind trees, and it was rotating at the same time. And then it finally landed. They finally went to a park, and Yanjino, I can't pronounce it, Hebei Province, at the National Forest Park in Fuchun, and they saw the ET come out. They saw the hatch open up, and the ET actually came out. I can go into details, but so little time. But the thing is that as soon as the alien turned around, he saw the people, and they ran off. They stopped the camera, and they ran off. Now, I looked at this video a lot, and I looked at its heel, its foot on the ground. It's a little bit hard to see. It's kind of blurry, but then it's half blurry and half clear. I wonder if Kevin Randall knows anything about this, because if the aliens landed before in New Mexico with Lonnie Zamora, in that case, in Zimbabwe, Africa, in other cases, you think it's not going to happen again in China?
All right. Kevin, do you know about this Chinese case?
I don't know very much about it. And the problem with things like that is there is no way for us, meaning here in the United States, to investigate a case like that.
Not in China, no.
And with Lonnie Zamora, I could talk to the people involved. I could call them on the phone. I could go visit them in their houses. With China, you can't really do that. But he's absolutely right. If you've got Lonnie Zamora seeing creatures from inside the craft, outside the craft, and leaving footprints on the ground, as they talked about there, then why wouldn't it happen elsewhere? There, in the Project Blue Book files, I think there are three cases in which there are occupant reports, people seeing the creatures, that are not labeled as psychological problems. Almost every report of people being involved with seeing the creatures, the Air Force wrote off as some kind of a psychological problem of the witnesses. There's only three cases. One of them is from Germany, and all we have is we don't have a good investigative case in it. And to find it in the Project Blue Book files, you have to look in the right place because it's misfiled and it's mislabeled, and so it's hard to find. But there are those three cases where people have seen it. So he's absolutely right that there's no reason to expect United States to be the only place where they've landed and the creatures have been seen outside the craft. A lot of good cases from Brazil. I have a lot of friends in Brazil that I communicate with that talk about some of the good cases down there. There's a Canadian case that's going on that looks like it's pretty good as well. So there's a lot of stuff going on, and it's sometimes hard for us to investigate all the cases that we'd really like to take a look at.
And there are apparently lots of cases in China, but like you say, it's difficult to get the information out of them.
And the other problem we have is the tabloids, and you know, thinking like the National Enquirer. But the National Enquirer, when Bob Pratt was working for it, was doing a good job of doing the UFO investigations. But they would come up with these bizarre cases in places you could not get to the people, you could not do any follow-up investigation, you couldn't verify any of the information. That's the one thing that we need to do as UFO investigators: verify the information. Can we find corroborative evidence for what the witnesses saw or who the witnesses are, in fact. Sometimes you want to vet the witnesses and you find out they're not who they claim to be, especially when you're dealing with foreign nationals and the whole ufological thing.
East of the Rockies, Linda's with us in Richmond, Virginia. Hi, Linda.
Hi, good evening, gentlemen.
Hi.
I have a question for your guest, but George, I wanted to ask you real quick. I've listened to you for ages.
Thank you.
Is there anywhere that I can go to hear you singing? YouTube or anything like that?
I don't know what you put in specifically, but there is some YouTube clips of me singing at these live events. So you might want to just type in George Norrie Sings and see what pops up there.
Mavericks, right? And I tried that, but I couldn't come up with anything.
Well, that depends on the city I'm in. We've got different groups all the time.
Oh, okay. All right. For your guest, in September 16th, 2018, in Alamogordo, New Mexico, they just mysteriously shut down the solar observatory. And they kept it closed for a while, and it was never released as to why this place was closed. And I was just wondering if your guest had any info in on that.
I have absolutely no information on that at all. I know the Solar Observatory is very important and figures in some older UFO sightings, but I know of nothing that – I have no idea why they shut it down. I flabbergasted, I guess.
We can't say it was anything sinister, that's for sure. Lots of people think some of these visitations may be coming from other dimensions, Kevin. Is that a possibility, too? I like the physical one. I like the fact that they're coming from other planets in our universe. But some people think they're coming from other universes, other dimensions.
Well, that's my feeling. A nuts and bolts explanation, interstellar flight, is the best explanation to my way of thinking, so I agree with you there. But there's always a possibility that we're wrong about that, and it is some kind of interdimensional. Or it could be time travel. My favorite one is time travelers, of course.
That they're us.
Yes, but they're time travelers, except, you know, there's very little possibility that that's real either. It's just my favorite theory because it's a fun thing to discuss. I've done a number of science fiction novels that have featured time travel in it, so I enjoy time travel. But I think the best explanation for what we've seen and the evidence that we've seen is a nuts and bolts interstellar flight as opposed to interdimensional. But we can't really rule that out because we don't understand interdimensional travel or if interdimensional travel is possible. And that may be they have to manifest themselves in some sort of material form that would leave the evidence that we now interpret as extraterrestrial and it's really interdimensional. But like you, I agree with the interstellar explanation.
How many years you been at this now, Kev?
Oh, I was going to say something like, most of the day, but...
long time.
I mean, seriously, going back probably about 50 years, and I hesitate to say because that dates me. But, of course, if I was in Vietnam, that certainly does as well.
Well, didn't they get a lot of UFO cases in Vietnam at the time?
When I was there, I had no idea if they had UFO cases. We were busy flying combat assault missions. And my grandmother did send me a copy of Frank Edwards' Flying Saucer Serious Business while I was there. So
right.
I could continue my study that way. But I was not involved in any UFO cases. And the same thing in Iraq. There were one or two things that were mentioned through the CIPRNet, but nothing that was really exciting UFO cases. When I was in Air Force Intelligence Office, there was something called the Weekly Intelligence Brief, and they may still do that. And there were both classified and unclassified stuff in there. And I just remember one case that was unclassified. A crew near Japan had seen something strange in the sky, and it was reported in the Weekly Intelligence Brief. But there was really just kind of the lights in the sky type thing as opposed to a really good UFO sighting.
All right, Kev, we're going to come back and take final calls with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And we'll be back in a moment with Kevin Randall and take final phone calls as we talk about his incredible new book called The Best of Project Blue Book. What an amazing time that was to live during that era, too. It was something else, watching these stories and listening to Hynek being interviewed, and just fantastic. I had a chance to interview Paul Hynek, J. Allen Hynek's son, at a couple live events and our program here, and He is convinced his dad became a believer after being a skeptic. It's an amazing story. But we'll be back with final calls in a moment. Open lines next hour here on Coast to Coast, so get ready for that. And in addition to everything that's happening in your life because of COVID-19, why don't you share some of your strange or miracle stories with us? I'd like to hear that. Let's take a little break from all the COVID stuff, even though you can call in about that. But let's talk about some miracles and some magical things that have been happening. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, back with Kevin Randall. His book is called The Best of Project Blue Book. Let's get as many calls in as we can, Kev. Let's go to Wayne in Tacoma, Washington. Wayne, thanks for holding. Go ahead.
Good evening, gentlemen. Thank you. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
Sir George and Mr. Randall, I've got some favorite cases. I've been following the UFO scene for over 60 years. And reading magazines and newspaper articles, and of course, then the books that were coming out. Perhaps one of my favorite cases, I want to make a comment on this. One of my favorite cases are the Shag Harbor events. I think that Shag Harbor has one of the most interesting because it's the most witnessed, I think, by people on land, people on ships, people in submarines, and divers down and actually witness these alien beings repairing their ship underwater. It's an amazing story. And then, of course, here in the Northwest, actually just a little bit before Roswell, we got the Maury Island event with the craft that was just outside of Maury Island in the harbor there, and was metal that was dropping out of the ship onto a surface ship down below. Apparently, it killed the dog, and there was a lot of witnesses of that. The Air Force sent two officers up here to the Northwest to collect information and to some of the metal material that fell down, and they put it in their plane, and the plane crashed on the way back down to California. And Bill Burns did a lot of information and research on that, and he came out in his video on that and said that seems to be a lot of evidence for that. And then lastly, the Ronnie Mazzaro case, Zamora case, there seems to be a backstory on that, and that is that they landed there to pick up 12 astronauts. And I don't know if you have any information on that or not, but they landed in the wrong place, actually. They were supposed to land in another landing place. They didn't have their coordinates quite right. This is something that they had set up with the U.S. government to take 12 U.S. astronauts that didn't have any living relatives to a planet called Planet Serpo. I mean, it sounds like science fiction, but some of these stories on UFOs are actually that are actual fact are I think, much better than a lot of the science fiction that's out there. So I'm wondering, Kevin, if you have any information on any of these stories.
The Sag Harbor case is a very good case.
Great case.
And the problem is, during the Condon Committee in 1968, they got phone calls about Sag Harbor, and they were supposed to be investigating UFOs, and they said, well, it was just a couple of teenagers involved in that, and it's in Canada. We're not going to get involved with it. I think Chris Stiles and Don Ledger have done some amazing work on gathering documentation and interviewing witnesses. It's a very important case that we need to take a look at. I've heard the theories about the aliens landing in the wrong place. I'm not sure that really connects with the Socorro case, other than it was in New Mexico, and Socorro isn't that far from Alamogordo, where the landing was supposed to take place, and it in the same time frame. There was a book by Robert Emiger about that and made that suggestion. And I don't really get into that in the Best of Project Blue Book, simply because I was focusing mainly on the Zamora case and the information that was gathered at that point. So I've kind of stayed away from that other aspect. There's other books I've done where I've kind of touched on some of that. I think the UFO dossier has some information about the possibility of the landing at Holloman Air Force Base. So, you know, that's kind of where we are on that.
What do you think of Rendlesham, that story from the United Kingdom?
Well, I of course know John Burroughs and Jim Pettiston, and I've talked to Charles Hall a couple of times. In the book that's coming out, UFOs in the Dark State, I actually go into more depth about that.
Aha, okay.
And how the Air Force OSI is involved in some of the manipulation of what their memories might have been. There's some manipulation going on, some interesting things going on there that suggest it's more than just a UFO landing. There's something more going on.
Interesting. We'll wait till that book comes out. Lola in St. Louis, welcome to the program. Hi, Lola.
Hi, how are you?
Wonderful. Hope you are too.
I've been listening to you guys since Art Bell first went national.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
I called you a few years ago and told you about my dad. He was a crash investigator for Convair in 47. I was 10 years old, and he was summoned to New Mexico. They thought it was an Air Force plane that crashed.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he came back. I believe he flew out on General LeMay's plane and came back with LeMay and Ramey, and they were at Carswell, and my mother and I took him a change of clothes out, and then they flew on to Lima, Ohio, and to Whiteman. And then when he came home, he was summoned to Washington, and so we made a summer vacation out of it, and he went in and talked to President Truman. And while he was in there, we had a tour of the White House, and then we had a tour of Washington with the government. And then he had to go speak at the Pentagon. So
what did he ever tell you, Lola, and your mother, what happened?
He said there were some little people in those planes, and they took planes or the UFO up.
Correct, yeah.
And with the people in them, and I believe there were supposed to be three of them, and two were dead and one was alive. Now, and then we were told, you keep your mouth shut or else. So we did.
Did you remember your father telling you this? I mean, did he look scared or nervous or anything like that?
He was changed totally after he came back. He was carefree and like a young guy when he went out there. And when he came back, he was totally different. He never...
Wow.
And he did not... After we were told to keep our mouth shut, we never said another word, and he never spoke of it again.
That's fascinating.
But I have a picture of my mother and I standing outside the White House that a street photographer took of us. And I have the picture here because my kids didn't believe it, and I showed them the picture, and I said, then I told them, they said, they like most people, they don't believe it, you know, but that's okay.
Do you care to mention your father's full name?
Oscar N. Shivers, and he died in 2005.
Ever hear the name, Kev?
No, sure haven't, but there was there's like 1,500 guys assigned at Roswell in 1947, and we didn't get to all of them either. And
that's a great story, though, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It sounds somewhat reminiscent of Frankie Rose's tale. She was the daughter of a firefighter in Roswell in 1947, and he went out to the crash site in his private car, which is why we could never find the record about it, and saw the bodies. And I think he said there were two dead and one alive, and the one was taken to the Roswell, the Army Airfield Hospital. But Frankie Rowe passed away just a couple of years ago, but she was a marvelous lady and was able to help us. We got corroboration from her story from her sister and some other people that helped define exactly what she'd said. So, you know, that's somewhat similar to the Frankie Rowe story.
Let's go to Mark, Baltimore, Maryland. Welcome to the show, Mark. Go ahead, sir.
Oh, thank you so much, George. And
thank you, Mark.
A great show. And it's an honor. Number one, thank you for your service. I'm a veteran myself, and it's an honor to talk with not only one of the preeminent investigators, but one of the most renowned investigators. And
absolutely.
I have all the books you've written and co-written, and looking forward to the new book. So speaking of books, the late retired Colonel Philip Corso, of course, published his book the day after Roswell on the 50th anniversary of the event, and made the cover of Time magazine. The first edition, of course, had senior Senate leader Strom Thurmond's vouch for the late colonel. I've read the book many times, and to me it makes perfect sense, having some experience in aviation as a veteran. So I'd like to ask you, sir, Mr. Randall, what you might have to say about his book, and if you could speak to your take on the veracity of his story.
Sure. Written by our friend Bill Burns, but go ahead, Kev.
Well, I hesitate to say this, but there's some problems with the book. And the one that I have is the convoy from Roswell to Wright Field carrying the bodies.
Mm-hmm.
I was in an aviation unit. We treated the aviation assets, the aircraft, like people treated their cars. We didn't drive anywhere, we flew. And you've got the bodies of the alien beings in Roswell. Why would you convoy them when you could fly them to Wright Field and they would be there in a matter of hours rather than have to remain overnight at Fort Riley in Kansas? And I don't understand why they would unload the trucks and take the crates into a building. If we were running the convoy, I'd have my own guards on it, and we would rotate the guards, of course, in four-hour shifts or two-hour shifts or whatever, but we wouldn't unload the trucks. So I have some problems with the way the story of how he saw the alien creature evolve. I have some real problems with that sort of thing. There are aspects of the story that are based on the evidence that has been uncovered. So, I mean, you have to take a look at Corso's story and decide for yourself whether you want to accept it as completely authentic or if there's some problems with it. As I say, I have some problems with it, but, you know, that's part of the job of the investigators.
Absolutely.
What you believe to be the truth from what somebody else believes to be the truth. You've got to get down to what the evidence shows you.
Let's go to Nick in Garden City, New York. Hi, Nick. Welcome.
Hey, George. Hey, Colonel Randall. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
You know, guys, this is just my opinion. I think at some point this stuff is just going to come out, and there's just no way to hide this forever. So I got a question. Why doesn't another country or a leader, say someone like Vladimir Putin, just say, hey, you know what, let's beat America to the forefront. Let's be the first to announce this to the world. And what do you think is stopping them from doing that, in your opinion?
There have been any number of world leaders who have done exactly that. The problem is that the ridicule curtain.
Nobody believes them.
Yeah. A friend of mine, Bob Cornett, and I were writing a book about a vampire, and a fiction book, of course. And the guy who knows the vampire is real says, well, I'm going to tell the world about it. He says, and the vampire says, go ahead. Nobody's going to believe you anyway. And that's kind of where we are on the UFO thing.
That's
go ahead,
a good point.
Tell them. They're not going to believe you anyway. And I think that some of the world leaders who may have access to the inside information do not want to get involved in the UFO field. We have our presidents. And when I was doing the book on the deep state, I looked at the Carter sighting and what Carter had done when he was running for president. He's going to release all the UFO information. And before he was even inaugurated, he started his investigation. He went to George Bush, the leader of the CIA at the time, and says, you know, what can you tell me? And Bush wanted to remain director of the CIA, and Carter was going to bring in his own guy. And so when Bush heard that, when Carter came to him to ask about UFO, he said, well, you know, you're not cleared to know that. I'm not going to tell you anything about it. And, of course, Bush was out of the CIA, but he knew he was going to go anyway.
Yeah.
But the important thing is that even before he was inaugurated, he was trying to get this information, and yet after he became president, that all sort of dried up. And you have to say, what happened there?
Very interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, and so I kind of explore that in UFOs in the Dark State, but, you know, that's not going to be out until May. But it's one of the things that I looked at and talked to a number of people about the Carter sighting and Carter's reaction to UFOs. And so you've got this guy who wants to talk about it, and he's looking to do it even before he's inaugurated, and somehow they shut it down.
Kevin, what's your gut tell you about us finding out the real truth about UFOs? Are we going to?
Eventually. Eventually contact is going to be made, and we're going to know. But until they decide that they're going to make contact with us, and I don't know why they wouldn't. Well, maybe it's because every time somebody lands, we shoot at them.
Yeah.
But until they make the contact, we're not going to have disclosure. They're going to have to initiate disclosure. But I think we're eventually going to get to it. We may reach a point where the evidence is so overwhelming, even though we can't point to a craft or the bodies, but we have so much evidence that's overwhelming that people are going to say, yeah, it's true. Let's move on from that.
What do you think most people, the rank-and-file folks, would simply say, I knew it. I knew it.
And I think originally the idea was this would start a mass panic because we don't know how to deal with it. But now we're dealing with something that we've been talking about for more than 70 years. And so you announce, yes, they're real, and people are going to say, you know, this has not affected my life one bit. I don't care. We've got to deal with the virus. Here in Cedar Rapids, we're dealing with this massive storm that just turned everything upside down. So when people say, well, UFOs are real, the idea is, who cares? I got this other problem I have to deal with in my life right now, this minute.
And now we have COVID-19 to take our minds off things, don't we?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And what's that then? And I say, we here in Cedar Rapids haven't been really talking about COVID-19 because of the storm damage that came through.
That's right.
We have to deal with the immediacy of the problem as opposed to these esoteric things like UFOs being real.
Kevin, thank you so much for being on the program again. It's always great to talk with you. Get you back in May when the other book comes out, The Best of Project Blue Book, available on Amazon.com. We will be back with Open Lines.